Hi, this is Barry Liskin, Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. What do the Velvet Underground, Lou Reed, and operations research have in common? No, our guest today is not Patti Smith. In today's segment, we talk to Dr. Laura McClay of Virginia Commonwealth University, author of the blog Punk Rock OR. We're broadcasting from the Fall 2011 INFORMS Annual Meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina. And Professor McClay, a pioneer in operations research and social media, has been talking about her blog and her own research at the conference. Professor McClay, welcome to the Science of Better.
Hello, Barry. It's good to be here.
So the obvious question is, how did you pick the name Punk OR?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I wanted to start a blog for a few months before I officially began it, and I had the pleasure of having two great advisors, one as a master's student, one as a PhD student, who are probably the two engineers that are best at marketing, and just thought it would be a great title name. I like punk as well as other music, but punk is very politically aware, and I'm always interested in public programs and public OR, so it seemed like a good fit.
Ah, okay. And how did you become interested in social media, particularly in using it to communicate it rapidly about our specialized field?
I started blogging not really to evangelize the masses about OR necessarily. I meant to evangelize the masses in order to convert them to becoming OR students. And so younger students read blogs. Not that many people have OR as a major. And I'm in a college, Virginia Commonwealth University, where our OR department is in with statistics.
Uh-huh.
And very few people start college even as a statistics major. My background's in engineering, and there's engineers all over the place, and it's easier to get people interested in OR because they might choose industrial engineering as a major.
Right, that's usually an engineering school is a stop-off point or
right.
A starting point.
So that's how I got started with blogging. I don't know if I've succeeded at converting too many students into operations research. Hopefully I have. I have gotten quite a few emails over the years.
It looks like it's fun.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, and, you know, it's a journey. I think I started the blog just before I became pregnant with my second child, and, you know, I felt very insecure about blogging about the challenges I had as a woman in operations research and having children, and do I talk about these things? And so there was a lot of self-discovery along the way, and I felt very accepted by people in my field.
And writing is a way to have to conduct self-discovery. Some people say, I don't know what I think until I write it.
Right. And it's also peer-reviewed as a blog. Very few blogs don't.
That's an interesting thought for an academic.
Right. So you don't just have the self-discovery from writing. You have other people giving you feedback, you know, that you're a trailblazer, which I think is very generous, or just giving me ideas and just making me feel better about the decisions, and definitely seen as a woman blogger as well as just an operations research blogger. And one of my favorite posts in the last few weeks was about five posts on women and engineering, and I think there were actually six or seven posts that week that were emailed to me by men. And I felt that maybe that they had gotten interested in this type of thing because of they had read my blog.
Uh-huh. And I think we're going to talk about that a little bit more we move forward. Can you contrast the way you use different social media? You were on a panel at our conference that discussed this. So when you blog, when you Twitter, when you podcast, and so forth.
That's tough to answer because social media changes so rapidly. I think blogging is pretty stable. Bloggers were people at the time, People Magazine, People of the Year in 2004. And it's just a great platform for getting information out there. But then we look at Google+ and LinkedIn and Twitter, and I use them very differently now than I did a year ago. But I blog in much the same way now than I did a year ago. And so I think part of how I use social media is I have to just be willing to put myself out there a little bit and try some new things, get started slowly if I can. And Twitter's a great example where I mainly observed once I signed up for an account.
And the culture itself is changing.
It is. So part of that is just being accepting of that and doing our best.
And you mentioned that you've been blogging in a similar fashion. Looking ahead, do you imagine yourself blogging in similar ways or any changes that you have in mind?
It took me a while to find my blogging voice and to find my way. Hopefully I've gotten pretty good at it. I wish I had more time for it, but I get enough posts out there, so I'll probably continue in much in the same fashion.
Uh-huh. And at the conference, you participated in the panel we talked about dealing with social media and OR. Were there any important takeaways, anything there that you hadn't thought of before or that you recommend to our listeners?
I would recommend giving Twitter a chance. I think that was a big theme of the panel, that we were all initially skeptical and resisted. And it's hard to describe Twitter because we've all heard about how terrible it can be, but it can be used in different ways. And I describe Twitter as the new water cooler. And it's a place where I can really engage my colleagues and have a lot of fun. And
yeah, of the social media that were discussed at this panel, it was surprisingly LinkedIn that left most people feeling, I don't know what to do with this other than to say I'm looking for a new job.
Yes, and that came up last year in the panel, but since then, LinkedIn has made all these improvements to the, and we're still underwhelmed.
Mm-hmm. There are discussions, and Informs has discussions there, but clearly they're not as frequent as they are on some of the other platforms that have been discussed, like something called OR Exchange.
That's true.
What do you, looking at Informs, what do you see as the role of social media in an organization like Informs? And Informs Vice President Bjarne Christensen also discussed this at the panel yesterday.
Yeah, I think that as an organization promoting operations research, one of the differences between an organization and an individual is that perhaps Informs might want to promote content. So with blogs, we write a lot about content. We can include papers and figures. Can't really do that in Twitter with 140 characters.
Right.
But just promoting us to share our slides. There's been a lot of limited sharing of conference slides, and there's, I don't know, how many thousands of talks going on.
And now there is something called slide sharing,
right,
which makes it possible.
Right. And so we need to get content out there. And once it's out there, we're pretty good at sharing it and voting up which, you know, presentations are worth looking at with all the social media.
Yeah, it is nice to have social media that lets you vote both thumbs up and thumbs down.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them kind of restrict you to just clapping or being silent.
And well, Twitter does too. You can vote up and down, but it's very implicit. You see it with the retweets and the discussion that might follow.
Right. Let me remind our listeners that this is A Science of Better with Barry List of Informs. Our guest today is Laura McClay of Virginia Commonwealth University. Let's look at some of the recent topics you've chosen to blog about, and we started talking about this before. You blog about women in engineering and, on a related note, the work-life balance. How do these topics affect you as a woman and as an operations researcher?
They have a profound effect. So since I've started blogging about them, there's an obligation to keep up with them. And it's really great to read about all the current research that happens on this topic. It's profoundly positive. And I think people are shocked for me to be really proud of how far we've come as women in operations research. And sometimes there's a negative spin, but when you actually compare apples to apples and look at some of the research, things have moved in a good direction.
And how hard is it for a woman to raise kids and be a professor?
It's not easy if you are not a professor. So it's just a challenge to have a family. But I think we can also help each other as long as we're willing to talk about it and discuss it.
And that's where social media encourages the discussion.
It does. It helps.
Now, you're in public policy, and we're speaking right now in the midst of the Republican Party debates leading up to the presidential primaries. And right now, President Obama's approval ratings are fairly low. What intrigued you about the modeling of Alan Lichtman, who forecasts that the president will be reelected? Alan, by the way, appeared as a guest on The Science of Better.
Yeah, and that was a great podcast. Well, before the last election, I blogged about predicting the election quite a bit leading up to the election. And immediately after, I discussed OR and the inauguration and the million people that were supposed to be in the Capitol. But we're a year out from the election, and there's pretty much one model that you can use a year out to predict who might win the election. The Republicans haven't even nominated anybody yet. And so I decided to write a post and posted it the election day on 2011, exactly 1 year before the presidential election. I thought it was a good time to get the ball rolling. And there'll be more posts, and I'll be using other models as well.
Mm-hmm. So far, his keys have held up fairly well, so we'll see whether they continue to hold up looking into 2012.
That's true. My husband tells me that Obama is no longer charismatic. We're so used to him that we've all raised the bar, so maybe that one doesn't count. But, you know, we'll have to see how things go with the election and reevaluate that model a little bit.
You're also a sports fan. At this time when the book and movie of Moneyball are popular, what are your takes on, say, an operations researcher like Russ Ohlendorf, an OR grad who's pitched for the Yankees and the Pirates? And I'll ask you a follow-up about quarterbacks after that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm really glad Moneyball came out. I know Mike Trick had a great blog post about it. And somebody told me to read that a couple years ago. And this is a must-read for operations researchers. It just addresses so much about the modeling process, what happens if the model gives you results that are unintuitive. Mm-hmm. If your model's good, that has a lot of value to the organization. And if not, then maybe there's something wrong with your model. And it's very hard to teach those concepts in a classroom. And so I read that book in the middle of a semester when I was teaching probability and statistics to undergraduates. And I remember one of my students, he was really tough to engage, and he sat in the back and didn't always pay attention. And I started talking about Moneyball and sports analytics, and I've never seen anybody perk up and turn his attitude around in class so quickly.
Uh-huh. You can hit on a sports fan's interest or anybody's interest, though.
Yes. That's true. It can help out, and it can definitely help out our lectures a little bit.
Now, as I recall, you did some examination of quarterback statistics.
Yeah, and I'm going to say, as a Bears fan, I really don't like to go there most of the time because the Chicago Bears have had a history of not having one of the top quarterbacks in the league. And I've always said that, you know, I'd be much more interested in sports analytics if I could mathematically prove that the 1985 Bears were the best football team ever.
Sometimes you do have to go with a gut.
Exactly. There you go. That's a good answer. So we were looking at quarterback ratings lately, and Wayne Winston has a wonderful book called Mathletics. And I've used some of his material in my classes, and when they don't fit in my class, sometimes they make the blog, and this is one that made the blog. And there's the typical quarterback rating, which is kind of arbitrary, although some would argue that it's not, and that it takes together everybody's or a quarterback's performance in all these different categories and lumps it together with a score. And amazingly, it seems to work pretty well. The score seems to rank the quarterbacks about how you'd expect them to be ranked.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne Winston has an alternate approach, and then there's a third approach, and I forget who has a third quarterback rating. And so one of the blog posts compared how the quarterbacks would be ranked differently. And most of them, they didn't change the ranking very much. And there were a couple of quarterbacks, one of which I remember was Cam Newton, who was ranked completely differently in the three ranking schemes. In the traditional quarterback rating, he appeared to be a very mediocre quarterback, but he's the one quarterback people can't seem to stop talking about this year. As that a rookie, he's been very productive.
We need to find some new metrics that will account
right.
for this.
But how do you validate that approach? We didn't get into that in the blog, but you have to use your gut to verify that maybe some models are more effective or more appropriate than others.
Now, another popular sports area in OR is March Madness. Is that your favorite time of year? And what's your approach to bracketology, as it's become known?
It is my favorite time of year. I get more readers in that week of filling out the tournaments. And I will say this last year I learned that that people can no longer revise their brackets, they stop reading blog posts about March Madness. But there's a golden week in OR blogging that it's just wonderful to write about. People are very anxious to figure out how to win a bracket. And it's something that I really get into. I grew up in a big city and didn't really follow college basketball until college. And there's so much data, there's so many games that have been played that you can really draw some interesting inferences.
I'm Barry List of Informs, and we're talking today with blogger Laura McClay about punk rock OR. Let's return to public policy.
Sure.
You're an officer in the Informs section on public programs, service, and needs. Have you encountered any intriguing research in this area that was presented at the Informs annual meeting?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of intriguing research, and I try to plug our posts. I wasn't able to attend to any of Michael Johnson's community-based operations research panels here. I'm sure they were all excellent. I just came from an SPPSN session, and Julie Ivey presented some wonderful work on equitably distributing food in food banks, according to counties, according to need, and how there are several possibly flawed ways of distributing equity according to a given organization's mission. And they might have some surprising resource allocations. And we all want something that's fair, but it's very interesting when you see a talk like that, that when you write down what you mean by fair and look at the implications, sometimes it's, maybe I don't like fairness. It seems that many of the models might lead to things that would still disenfranchise some people on the individual level. So I think that equity and fairness is a great topic when presented well, as Julie did, and can really lead to a lot of further discussions.
And it's challenging to achieve that fairness and equity, as you're seem to be saying.
But it highlights the research need, both theoretically and applied, that needs to be done because there are so many gaps.
Healthcare is an area of your interests, and at the conference you presented several papers in this area, particularly in emergency medical services and dispatching ambulances. Why is this a ripe area for operations researchers?
Oh, it's a great area for operations research. So first of all, EMS systems throughout the country can vary considerably, and big cities have very elaborate systems to dispatch ambulances effectively, and once they do dispatch ambulances, they might relocate them. The city of Richmond, for example, puts ambulances on street corners, so they're ready, they're already in the vehicle, in the ambulance. But in other situations, maybe the ambulances stay at a station and they're not relocated. And the county that supplies data for me, as well as many research ideas, does not relocate ambulances. And in fact, when they send an ambulance, it's on average busy for an hour and a half. So some discussions arose about, well, what ambulance do you send? So if there's a real emergency, you'd always send the closest one. But what happens if it's not an emergency, something like a sprained ankle and somebody needs a ride to the hospital? If that ambulance is going to be gone for an hour and a half, then there might be true emergency patients that could be located nearby where that ambulance would be, that would then not be able to be treated in a timely fashion.
So we're talking about a different kind of, that ambulances are equipped with different equipment or are built to different specifications.
There's that, and sometimes they all have the same specifications, but you need to save the ambulances in the area that have the highest population density, at least through emergencies. Mm-hmm. But how do you really do that? And so optimization is a great tool for answering that question.
I've seen several papers on emergency rooms and speeding up ambulance dispatch, but I hadn't run into one focusing on the effect of bad weather on emergency services. That's a paper you presented, and what interested you in it, and what are some of your findings?
Well, I also do a lot of homeland security research, and then I started to do emergency medical service research. And EMS systems really respond to very routine health emergencies. They can be catastrophic to the patient, of course. But homeland security, a single event could affect an entire city. And I was really interested in looking at something in between. How would you use these ambulances that are designed to respond to routine emergencies, how could they help or be adjusted to also help patients during more severe emergencies?
And in fact, as we concentrate on homeland security, mm-hmm. sometimes we're forgetting the fact that a hurricane or a snowstorm is as great a threat to a community
exactly.
as a terrorist attack, perhaps a greater threat.
Yes. They all could be catastrophic events. If not catastrophic, then certainly disasters. And so a couple years ago, we had Snowmageddon, and there were about three enormous winter storms that went through the area and left a lot of snow. And it was we collected data during that time, and it was just a great opportunity to see exactly what happened. I mean, I had an idea that there would be more calls during that time. But to actually quantify the change in response time and to see how long that lasted, which basically is how long it takes to plow out all the neighborhoods, the effect on the service time, the calls maybe go up during a snowstorm, for example, but that's because there's a lot of low-priority calls that dilute the total calls in the system. There's actually the same amount of emergencies, and that was actually a surprising finding. But when you see all the cars on the side of the road, it makes sense to be able to verify that.
So people who would have been able to drive to the hospital if it weren't a snowstorm now need an ambulance because they don't have a four-wheel drive truck.
That's true. And in Virginia, we're not all that prepared for snow. Some of my neighbors don't even own shovels.
Oh, okay.
so,
I understand you did modeling based on real-life data from the Virginia County near your university. What kind of data did you examine, and what were your findings? This is along similar lines.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so we were able to collect all the calls over a year during a period, and we were able to actually supplement the data with real-time weather information that was collected. There's a small regional airport right in the middle of the county, so it's perfect, and they release weather information about every hour, so plus or minus 30 minutes of every call. So it's pretty accurate. And we looked at some other information as well. So living in the area along a major interstate, there's more traffic on beautiful summer weekends than there is during rush hour because everybody's traveling to the beach to and from D.C. Mm-hmm. or New York. And so we incorporated some of our knowledge about the local region as well. There's an amusement park that's open in the county, and surprisingly, there appear to be an increase in the number of cardiac arrest-related calls when the amusement park is open.
Huh.
But we're not really sure about the cause and effect, so keep writing.
You're not sure if it's people going on rides that are affecting their health.
That's true. We didn't look at where they occurred. I've subsequently looked at a little bit. It doesn't seem to really be raising the risk, but at least within the amusement park.
Mm-hmm. Final question, what research are you working on now that we should be reading about, and any blog entries we should be on the lookout for?
I don't have any blog entries immediately planned. Just keep reading and you'll find some good ones. In terms of research, I'm doing a lot with emergency management during severe weather events, and also looking at some interesting homeland security questions about how would you model an adaptive adversary, maybe one that's not perfectly rational. And
that's a very important topic, because adversaries are not just sitting targets. If you are trying to outwit them, they catch on and try to outwit you.
That is true. But sometimes even a model that might be oversimplifying an intelligent adversary could still have value. And I think we need to remember that with our operations research models. They don't need to be perfect. They just need to be useful.
And if they're not perfect and get out there more quickly, you may be helping people a little bit sooner.
Exactly.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Dr. Laura McClay of Virginia Commonwealth University. Professor, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Science at Better podcast by INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.